Welcome back, everybody, to the Reflex Blues Show. I am your host, Donovan Beery, and today we bring, via the magical world of the intertubes of the internet and Skype, Sarah Wachter-Betcher. Sarah, how are you doing today?
Hey, Donovan. I'm doing really well. How are you?
Good. And I understand you're like the main editor over there, the editor-in-chief of A List Apart.
Yeah, I am. I have been the editor-in-chief there for a little over 2 years now.
And now, A List Apart's been one of these sites where, I mean, back in the day when I didn't know, well, even not that I know a lot now, but it's just been just a wonderful resource for anyone who wants to do web development. I remember using it a few times for, you know, trying to find some CSS tricks or trying to find anything that was great. You guys always had, like, great articles that explained how to do things, but in a way that designer could read in a way.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, A List Apart has been around now for, gosh, more than 15 years, actually since 1998. And it was founded by Jeffrey Zeldman, and there's been a few editors there over the years. But the magazine is really for designers and developers, yes, but also actually for anybody who works on the web and is interested in thinking about how we make things online. And so our articles have expanded a bit. At first, I think there was a lot more about code tricks and things like that because it was, you know, late 90s web design. People were really trying to figure things out.
And that's how I was introduced to it, was trying to find code tricks. And as I said, the trick is you find the code tricks, and if they're written by straight programmers, they're almost unreadable if you're not a programmer. It's like they're written in a different language. But A List Apart was always written in a way that, as a designer, I could be like, oh, this makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big goal of ours, is to make sure that even though we might cover some niche topics, we're giving people context, that we're making it accessible to a broader range. So I'm the editor-in-chief there, but I'm definitely not a developer. I am a content strategist, and so I'm able to work with our authors directly and help them with things like, you know, how do they tell their story? How do they give our readers enough background information but not, you know, be a whole history book? How do they build out their examples in such a way that pretty much anybody can follow them, even though some of them are going to be used by a more specific audience? And so I think that's one of the things that makes A List Apart really special, because it's something that isn't just trying to teach you a trick. It's trying to shape how you think about the web and how you think about your craft and what you do.
What's been the favorite thing that you've written on there, or that I guess being the editor-in-chief, I assume you have to kind of read over everything that gets submitted?
Yeah, for the most part, you know, we have several other editors on staff who do different things. It's a side project. It's a labor of love for everybody involved. And so it's something that I work on, you know, an hour or two a day here and there all week long, and same with a bunch of other editors. And for me, one of the things that's incredibly fun is being able to work with authors, because we do spend a lot of time with them. It's not send us a post and we get it up on the site. It's more like, tell us about what you want to write about. Okay, let's see a draft. Let's talk about that, and let's talk about how do we strengthen this, how do we make this something that's really useful for people, et cetera. And so during that time, I've gotten to know lots of different people and publish people in so many different fields. One of the things that I've been really excited about recently is that we've started talking more about, you know, if A List Apart is there to make your community better and stronger, then let's also talk about issues in our community that maybe aren't related to code. Let's talk about culture. And so we started to talk to some authors who want to write about things like, how do we make, you know, more positive, diverse environments? How do we handle issues like sexism and abuse and harassment in our industry? And so I'm really excited to delve into that as well. I think it's a good addition to some of the other stuff that we've been doing. So that's been something I've been really keen to do, especially over the last few months. And we've been starting to write about that.
Now, when you say, now, I mean, I'm in the design industry, and I know, like, there has been a, I mean, you watch Mad Men, you realize there's been a history of sexism and such.
Sure.
But I know that, like, as the years have gone on, there's, I think, more females entering the design profession than there are males. So when you say your industry, I assume you're kind of dealing with more of the development?
Well, you know, I think it's interesting, because I think it's impossible to say this industry equals this very confined thing with a box around it, because it's like, okay, well, if I consider myself part of the web industry, I'm kind of part of the tech industry, but the tech industry is a huge industry, and then the design industry is overlapping with those things. And so it's not like, I think there's a lot of gray areas. I think that there are pockets within all of these interconnected fields where you see a lot of women represented, and there are definitely pockets where you don't. Web development is still one of them. I think in general, professional industries tend to be, especially in the U.S., overwhelmingly white. We don't have a huge amount of diversity in that regard. And I think, though, that overall, regardless of whether there are lots of women represented in a field or not, there are still these endemic problems with things like women who aren't in positions of leadership, women who are being paid a lot less, things like that. So I think it's a complex issue, absolutely, and it's definitely not the primary thing that Alista Part covers, but it's something that we have realized if we want to push our community further, if we want like our community of readers further, that we need to make it part of what we do as well, because it's something that is definitely holding our community back right now.
Yeah, and I've actually been seeing like over the last year or even more frequently than that, this kind of being brought up more and more, which I think is great, because I think if we don't think about it, it just kind of disappears. To see more people writing about it, I think is, my guess is the way to start the conversation so that things can change, because it's going to change.
Absolutely. And I have seen that as well. There's been quite a groundswell of it. One of the reasons we decided it was something that fit with Alista Part was that we felt like it was really easy to ignore the blog posts and articles that were written on sites about, you know, women and diversity, because they were kind of niche sites that were able to say, oh, well, that's just a site for women to read about issues for women, as opposed to saying, no, this is a site that's about everybody in our community and how we do our jobs, and actually it's important enough to get it into a more mainstream place.
And where, by the way, the site is just called alistapart.com.
Yes.
But you guys refer to it as a magazine. Is it an actual magazine, or is it just a web magazine? I mean, I've never seen anything in print.
Well, what makes something have to be in print to be a magazine?
Well, that's what I'm asking. I mean, I love that you call it a magazine and that you have issue numbers, but I was just, mm-hmm. I just didn't know if that came about because it was an actual magazine, or if that just is something you guys just created.
It's absolutely always been a web publication. And the reason we think of it as a magazine is that we have issues. We publish on a schedule. Sometimes we'll explore themes. And we have a submissions process where authors submit ideas, they pitch us stories, and we work with them to develop that into an actual article. Magazine, I think, is especially appropriate because it's a lot like I would say more like a literary magazine. So we don't have like staff writers who are producing little bits and pieces. What we have are authors who are producing long, more essay-style articles. And those sometimes develop over several months. We do shorter form stuff, and we consider that the blog component of what we do. And you'll see if you look at the blog on our website, that those pieces are very different from what you'll find in the article section.
Okay. Well, one last question on the list apart before we take a break and move to our next topic.
Sure.
I mean, right now you got issue number 400 up. And there's so much content on Alista Part. If somebody goes there, they've never been there before, what do you recommend that they go to first? Like how do you expect them? I mean, what's the best way to get involved in the Alista Part community?
So if you're new to Alista Part, I would definitely read a couple of the recent articles and get a flavor of what we're talking about right now. But you might want to check out our topics section, which is where we organize and archive all of the past articles we've written. And we have those organized into different areas. So if you come in as a designer and you might want to be learning more about, say, responsive design, you know, maybe you're a designer who's been working on some web stuff but wants to understand more modern stuff, you can go right to a responsive design section and kind of dive into that more deeply. That can help you focus your search, because 400 issues is probably, you know, around 800 articles dating back over the years, and each of those articles is meaty and long, so that's a lot to get lost in.
You can spend all day there, and we appreciate all the effort you did. Well, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the How Interactive Design Conferences. Welcome back, everybody, to the Reflex Blue Show. We have Sarah with us. And This year at the How Inter- this thing this How Interactive Design Conference, we actually sent a reporter up there a few years ago on the first one. Ben Luters went to the San Francisco one, and now all of a sudden, next thing I see is that there's three of these things. There's one in Washington D.C., which is September 3rd through 5th. One in Chicago, October 19th through 21st. One in San Francisco, November 17th through 19th. I assume these are going well. I mean, Ben had a great time. He said it was very informative. So I assume they'll be doing this every year. But you're speaking at two of them this year, is that right?
Yeah, I'll be in Chicago and San Francisco.
All right, so let's not even talk about the DC one. Just nobody wants to go to that if you're not there.
Sure.
So
I'm sure it'll be a very successful, well-attended event. And if you are in the DC area, you should definitely go to that one. But I will not be there.
Right. So so the How Interactive Design Conference on these, they're bringing in different speakers to different ones. And it's still is the idea between the conference still that when we first covered this years ago, and I wanted to make sure that it hasn't changed beyond this, but the idea was is that, hey, you're a designer, you want to do more interactive, you really need a jump start to get going on it. Here's where you can see people that'll tell you what you need to do web design.
Yeah, and I think it's probably broadened a bit since then. You know, I was there 4 years ago, but I suspect it's broadened a bit to also include some people who've been pretty involved in web design for a while now. And so there's definitely some talks that are going to be at a range of different levels. And I think that it's also not just the design component, but taking a more holistic view of what does it take to build a website today.
Okay, and what is your talk about?
Well, my talk is going to be about content, because I'm a content strategist. So most of what I do when I'm not working on a list apart is working with clients on, you know, big complex websites and helping them make sense of what they're publishing and who they're talking to and why they're putting all that information out there and how we structure and organize it. So in my talk, I'm going to be talking about when you're working on a big website project, there's usually lots of content that exists already, lots of content that people think they need and want, and lots of conversations about what, you know, the design is going to look like and how development's going to go. But what we don't necessarily have a good plan for is how we orchestrate the content process during the design process.
And first off, where do people go to find out more about you before we get further into this?
Oh, sure. My URL is sarahwb.com, and that's just sarawb.com.
Okay, and how do you go about getting the content for a website? Like let's say most of our listeners are younger, so they're not working like 10,000 page sites, but let's say you're dealing with like a 20 page site. What is the first thing you should ask for when it comes to content on a website?
Sure. I think the first question is usually why. For pretty much anything, the question is why. My thoughts on content are that so often what we end up with is a design process where everybody gets really excited about colors and layouts and logos, and everybody goes head first into design. And then I see a lot of people talking about content more, but oftentimes the conversations are somewhat limited to things like, well, what's the voice and tone of our site going to be and things like that. And that's very useful, and that's definitely something you should do and it's helpful. But when it comes to translating sort of the bigger picture about what is our voice and tone or who are we trying to talk to into actually getting the content done, it can be a different story. So I think that what people need to be talking about is not just, you know, what do we need to say, who do we need to talk to, but also what do we have already, and is that stuff any good? Is it aligning with where we think we're going? What do our users actually want? What questions do they have? Can we ask them? Do we have research that can help us know the answer to that? Can we look at, you know, our past analytics on an old site and see what people have looked at in the past and make some good, insightful recommendations about what we actually want to do in the future? And then when it comes to content, I think, especially for designers, a huge part of it is not necessarily having all the copy first on a website. That's usually unrealistic, but you want to have a sense of what the content's going to be like. When I say a sense of what the content's going to be like, what I mean is you want to know what kinds of content are you supposed to be publishing? Is this a site that's going to need to have long-form content, or is it more short-form? Are they going to have little product descriptions? Is it going to be blog posts? What are the kinds of things that need to be there? And what's sort of the size and shape of those things? and also to understand prioritization. So like what messages are important, what kinds of information need to be front and center, what things could be maybe tucked away. And that's especially important, I think, if you're trying to deal with mobile, doing anything with responsive design, where you're trying to make decisions that will work on small screens. You want to know what's important so you can make sure that that stays intact, and that if there's things that are less important, that might be what gets tucked away behind a tap. And it's really hard to make those decisions as a designer if you haven't had good conversations about what happens with the content first.
And on this case, do you normally talk to the client, or do you talk to a copywriter, or do you bring in kind of, is it a group thing?
Well, I tend to look at it as a group thing, and that's definitely what I talk about a lot, because I think that for most organizations, and it, you know, kind of doesn't matter small or large, most organizations that are bigger than the tiniest of tiny companies tend to have multiple people involved in content in some way. And sometimes those people don't even realize they're involved in content. But they're people who say things like, oh, just put that up on the website. Oh, we have this new thing. We need to add that to our about section. Oh, you know, let's write a blog post about that, whatever. And so people are making all kinds of content requests, and they don't always necessarily have the same ideas about what's important and why it's important. And so it's very easy to say, let's hire a copywriter to just rewrite all of our crap. And you might need to hire a copywriter. In fact, most organizations probably do need to hire a copywriter. But before you get there, you need to get people on the same page about what they're doing. And you need people to understand and build good habits around content that are actually going to be sustainable, right? So you're not just plunking stuff on the website every time anything happens in your company, but you're doing it with purpose, and you're doing it in a way that people can still navigate and your users can still make sense of. So I think it's a lot of conversations with stakeholders, whoever's in charge, people who are making decisions, and the people who are having to manage that content ongoing, to figure out what's important and kind of get a plan in place before you start, you know, saying, well, let's just have a copywriter fix it.
Right. And so then a lot of times when you're done with the site and it's launched, and you said there's kind of an ongoing thing, is there ever times where you actually take a site and rather than like doing a redesign, you do like a content redesign?
Yeah, I think that's actually a big part of doing good content work, is understanding that there is a long-term piece to it as well. So I work on projects that are big redesigns sometimes, and obviously, like I've talked about, as part of that process, I'm also helping people think about what's going to happen after they launch. But then I also work with clients pretty regularly who aren't in the middle of designing a new site. What they're in the middle of is basically a realization that their content has become unmanageable for them. And so we'll start taking a look at what actually exists. We'll start maybe auditing some of the content that's on the site right now, or looking at how users are actually interacting with the information, and start making decisions about things that maybe, you know, don't need to be there. In fact, one of the things that's kind of crazy is that, you know, we've seen content marketing blow up, and people talk about you need to, you know, get more content, be publishing more content. And I think sometimes that's true and very, very valuable for businesses. But I also think sometimes businesses need less content because they're just making messes, and it's making it, you know, harder and harder for people to find information that actually allows them to like buy things from your company. So I think that it's definitely a big part of content work is being in it for the long haul and constantly kind of going back to your vision and your strategy and saying, are we actually doing that, or are we just posting crap up because we can?
And that's where I'm thinking, I'm like, that would be great as a designer to work with someone like that, that would be like, hey, we can remove a lot of this copy. And I'll be, thank you.
Absolutely. You know, yeah. The bane of designers' existence is they're like, I don't know what to do with all of this stuff. And it's like, well, the reason you don't know what to do with all of this stuff is that half of it doesn't mean anything or say anything. And if that's the case, you're just, you know, you're just decorating around it. You're not really designing.
How do you tell a client that half of their stuff is worthless?
Well, that's a complex conversation. So I think that for me, I have the benefit of usually going in with clients who know they need help, right? Like when I'm working with clients, it's often because they've realized they have a content problem and that's why they've called me. Now, it's a lot harder when they don't realize that they have a content problem. And so what I would say, and because I used to have to deal with this more often when I was working in an agency where they were like, no, we have a design problem. What I would say about that is that it's really helpful if you can go in and you can have them start to identify problems. So when you have them start telling you about what's wrong or telling you where their issues are, things like that, have them start start articulating stuff and just ask follow-up questions and follow-up questions until you start realizing, you know, what's actually at play there. Pretty often, when you poke at the problem a little bit, they'll start saying things like, well, you know, we were told we need to blog more and we're blogging all the time, but we just can't keep up and it feels like we don't know what we're saying anymore. And you're like, okay, well, that's a problem we can talk about. So it's just like asking those follow-up questions until you get to a place where you feel like you're solving something real as opposed to solving sort of a surface level issue.
No, I love it. Well, the How Interactive Design Conference, once again, there's going to be one in Washington, D.C. You'll be at the one in Chicago and the one in San Francisco. And then I think they're doing some other stuff. But I think the reason they do three of these is to keep it small enough that it's more of a workshop feel rather than a giant inspirational feel like the main How conference is.
Yeah, it'll be a little smaller than the main How conference and spread across the country. So hopefully lots of you from all over can be there.
All right. Well, we'll be right back and we'll wrap this up. All right, welcome back. And you were just talking off air about mobile, and I always forget. We talk about more and more, but over the last, I don't know, 2 years, like responsive has just come out of nowhere. Responsive web design. And yeah. And it seems that it's, I don't think that's going to stop, but I don't know.
You know, I am very confident it is not going to stop because a lot of the issues with responsive design have really started to be worked out. I mean, it's a new technique, right? And when you have new techniques, especially on the web, the web is not some sort of, you know, overlord that can say, like, yes, this is the way things will happen. The way things change on the web is that people start doing things differently, and then more organizations pick up on it, and then it becomes a standard over a long period of time.
Yeah, like, for us, what happened was we'd have clients all the time. They'd be like, oh, hey, can we get a mobile site? But this is, like, 3 years ago. So mm-hmm. We're like, we could build a custom mobile site and stuff. And then they kind of hear that there might be money involved, and then they kind of quit. And then, or they realized that not that many people did it, but all of a sudden when responsive came about and we realized, oh, we can do the coding for this while we're coding the website. There's not two sites to maintain. There's not that awkwardness. It was like one of these, mm-hmm. I guess this made sense. That made sense to us. So we started doing it.
Absolutely. And, you know, responsive design has taken off because it does solve a lot of these problems with having duplicate sites, having to maintain two sets of content, all this stuff that takes lots of extra time and money. You know, but it is an evolving technique. It's something where people are still coming up with all sorts of ways, like, oh, how do we deal with images responsively in a way that's not going to drag down bandwidth on people, you know, people who are on mobile and maybe don't have a good connection. Like, all these problems come up and then people figure out how to solve them. And it's really interesting to watch. So actually, going back to when we talked about A List Apart, one of the most amazing things about working at A List Apart is I get to work with Ethan Marcotte, who invented responsive design.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I talk to him multiple times a week, and I hear about the kinds of projects he's working on and what he's thinking about. I hear from our authors, who are the people who are coming up with new techniques. And so I'm finding that it's really exciting to see that evolve. And I think for me, you know, being a content person, so I'll always find a way to make it about content, is that it has really brought a lot of the content problems we've always had to the forefront and allowed people to start solving them, because people have said, oh, well, responsive design means I have one set of content, and that one set of content has to work across all these screen sizes. And they're like, oh, but my content right now is a mess. It doesn't make sense on a big screen. It's certainly not going to make any sense on a small screen. And so it's gotten people thinking more seriously, I think, about the way that they structure and organize their content, how much they have, the flexibility and adaptability of their content. Is it written in a way that it can be reused in different places? Those kinds of questions. And I think those questions were always important, but now suddenly people are like, oh, wow, this is so important, I cannot ignore it any longer. So in that way, I think mobile has actually been really great for people who care about content and for readers, for users who have to use our devices, because they're getting companies to actually pay attention to the content they're putting out there now.
No, and I also noticed the difference between, like, when you'd actually make a mobile site also and compared to responsive is with responsive, you kind of have these tablet sites that wouldn't have been invented otherwise. Like, things look great on a tablet.
Yeah, absolutely. And otherwise, you know, a lot of times what you would see is people would say, well, you know, our standard desktop type site. It looks okay on a tablet. It works okay on a tablet.
But this was also when not many people had tablets, and now there's
everybody has tablets.
It's actually
surprising, the numbers. I can't remember the stat off the top of my head, but it's something like 4 in 10 Americans have a tablet now, or 5 in 10, actually, like half. But yeah, so I feel like it's really made people stand up and say, you know, no, we're not just going to say, eh, good enough. We're going to try to design in a way that's going to give a good experience to all of our users, not a good enough experience.
And I could see where that does involve content. It involves design. It involves code. There's movable parts here, movable parts.
Yeah, and you know, the other great thing about it that's hard but good is that it also requires people to work together more. It's a lot harder to make a website that's going to be responsive and it's going to be adaptable and blah, blah, blah if you're all working in these silos. And so it makes designers, developers, content people have a lot more conversations, which, you know, changing process and workflow can be hard, but I think that that's ultimately really good for the end result and probably really good for our working relationships in general.
So when you talk to the guy that that came up with the, you know, that kind of invented the responsive design, did he realize that when he did this that it would take off like it has?
No, I think it was an idea he was very excited about when he first published about it. You know, he first published the responsive web design article in ListApart over 4 years ago now. And at first it was like, oh, that's an interesting idea. That's a neat trick.
Yeah, and the trick back then was the browsers just couldn't all do it yet.
Yeah, and so what you know, media queries weren't necessarily everywhere. But what's happened is that, you know, about a year after that article came out, his book came out, and that's when things really went nuts. And now I will say there were other people who were doing some similar or related things. It wasn't like, you know, he was alone in a dark room and came up with this concept.
No, I think
it's evolution, but he's definitely, you know, the person who established responsive design. And it's I think he did not realize it would be as big as it is. But it's pretty amazing to be at the center of all of that.
No, and it's great. And so the article's probably still up there somewhere on a list apart back in issue, I don't know, 300-something.
Yeah. It's just called Responsive Web Design, and it's by Ethan Marcotte. And you can find that search the website, go to the topics section, or go to the authors section and look for Ethan.
All right. Well, what's the next thing? What's the next future? You got any predictions here
for the future
of the web?
You know, what I really think is that what organizations are going to be struggling with for a long time is how much change mobile has really brought. And so what I think the next thing is it's really going to be dealing with how do we make experiences more interconnected, because we've got all these different pieces, different sites and mobile stuff and all these apps and whatever, all this stuff is flying around. How do we make experiences more connected for people and more adapted to what people are doing? So how do we allow people to, for example, start a task on their phone and finish it on their desktop later? How do we allow people to save our content for later and have that as like their personal repository of information? How do we basically make our experiences something that aren't just one size fits all and aren't just in one moment in time, but something that can be more seamless as people's contexts change and needs change?
No, and I'm sure. I don't know how to do that myself, but I'm sure the entire community will get there together somehow. Sarah, it's been wonderful to have you on the show. Hopefully, we'll catch up with you sometime in the future.
Yeah, great. Thank you so much, Donovan. Thanks for having me.
Hey, thanks again. Once again, everybody, if you want more information, 36point.com.
The Reflex Blue Show with Donovan Meary is hosted at 36point.com. Music by Dustlab. Find out more at myspace.com/dustlab.